watched, a full century of legionaries rushed out to form up in ranks facing the coach. A personal retinue, like his own perennially proximate gang of Marat riders, if somewhat more numerous. The legionaries snapped to attention as a valet hurried out to open the door of the wind coach. Tavi and the two large singulares exited first. The two men stood on either side of him. At one point in his life, he mused, the presence of such large men so obviously skilled in the arts of violence would have intimidated him quite effectively. Given, however, that the taller of the pair still came half a hand short of Tavi's height, and given both his training and his more recent but mounting knowledge of Furycraft, the most that they managed to do was elevate themselves in his thinking to the first targets he would need to deal with, should the situation devolve. When Arnos emerged from the coach, flanked by his other singulares, Tavi fell into pace beside him. His escorts were taken off guard by the confident motion and wound up trailing him by a step, more like attendants than anything else. "Senator," Tavi murmured, nodding with a polite smile to the centurion of Arnos's personal guard. "It occurs to me that a certain amount of reciprocity might be called for." Arnos glared up at him for a moment, and Tavi imagined the man torn between continuing the amicable facade and ordering his singulares to beat him senseless. "You're in no position to demand anything." "Nor do I make any demands," Tavi replied. "I simply wish to point out that you are quite correct. I'm beaten and politically dead." Arna stared at him as they mounted the stairs to the house he'd claimed, and his eyes narrowed in suspicion. "You have some point?" "The people of Othos," Tavi replied, arching a brow at Arnos. "You have what you want. There's no need to carry through with the executions now." "Oh, I don't know," Arnos said, his tone conversational. "Setting an early example might well smooth things down the road. I should think the fate of Othos would do a great deal to inspire the folk of other villages to be more active in their resistance of the enemy. Or inspire them to turn their hands against you." Arnos shrugged. "Freemen out here have little in the way of capability to do our forces any harm. They are virtually without Furycraft." Arnos gave Tavi a chill little smile. "Imagine what that would be like, Scipio." Tavi regarded the man steadily for a long moment. Tavi's assignment to the First Aleran as a cursor and spy for the Crown had never been intended to go on for so long. A lot of people had seen his face in the capital, and sooner or later someone must have twigged to the identical facial features of Rufus Scipio and Tavi of Calderon. Arnos was Lady Aquitaine's creature. Offhand, he couldn't think of anyone else with both enough intelligence resources to obtain the information and motivation to share that fact with Arnos. It was an educated guess, but Tavi felt fairly confident of it. For the immediate future, though, it hardly mattered where Arnos had gotten the information. It only mattered that he did have it, and therefore knew that he could strike at Tavi's patron by visiting harm on Tavi. "You've gotten what you wanted. Those people have done you no harm, Senator." "Nor given any help. I owe them nothing." "And that's reason enough for you to murder them?" Arnos shook his head once. "This is a war. The innocent die. They are killed by battles, caught in fires. They starve. They grow sick. It is unavoidable. No commander worth the rank lets his mind be distracted by such things." "Ah," Tavi murmured. "Quite distracting, humanity." Arnos let out a bark of laughter. "Please. Your heart bleeds no more than mine does. How many tears did you shed for the officers over you who died when you took command, How many men did you order to their deaths? How many bodies of the innocent have you seen during your stay here? And how long has it been since the sight of them made your gorge rise?" Sudden red rage flashed through Tavi at Arnos's words, but he suppressed it savagely. It was a near thing. 2 years in the field had killed hundreds of the men he commanded, and exposed him to depths of suffering he could never have imagined only a few years before. "You are the same sort of creature I am, Scipio, or Tavi of Calderon, or whoever you imagine yourself to be. You simply serve a different master." Tavi frowned at the man steadily. Arnas was unruffled, and unless Tavi was mistaken, he was entirely sincere. How could any sane person be so callous? The lives Arnas directly destroyed would not be the only blood on his hands. The repercussions would be shattering. Disease would run rampant. Children would be orphaned. Steadholts would be decimated, their harvests stifled for lack of labor. The shortage of food would drive men into brigandage and murder. Other men would kill for vengeance, while the women and children, as in all wars, suffered the most. The furies in the area, thrown out of balance by all the deaths of those wielding them, would devolve and go feral, causing even more problems and endangering anyone who crossed their paths. Tavi had seen it on a much smaller scale around towns and villages engulfed by the war. It was a nightmare. If Arnas continued this way, the first snows of winter would fall upon a land of death and decay presided over by fat, croaking crows. How could the man even conceive such a thing? Tavi blinked. The answer was simple. He didn't know. Arnas simply didn't know. Though he was one of the most respected men in the Collegia Tactica, Arnas had never actually served on a campaign. He had watched the morning's assault from his air coach high above, looking down upon the tiny figures running about far below him, the same viewpoint he would have enjoyed at a ludus board or on a sand table. He had been too far away to see the blood or hear the screams or to smell the stench of death. Bloody crows! The man was directing legions on a campaign against an implacable foe, yet he didn't even wear armor. Tavi was well aware how quickly the tides of battle could shift. His own dented armor bore testimony enough for it. It wasn't real to Arnas, Tavi thought. Or rather, what was real and what was going on in the senator's mind were two different things entirely. He was used to talking about war in abstract, comfortably distanced terms. He hadn't been there on the ground, and while he might have had an intellectual appreciation of the loss of human life that would ensue, he didn't know. He hadn't experienced it himself. Tavi shook his head. "I take it back," he said quietly. "You aren't going to do anyone any good." Arnas crooked a finger at Navaris. "I'm sure this house has a cellar or basement or storage closet of some kind. Lock him in it." "Arnas, please," Tavi said. "Rescind the order. Those people don't deserve to die, and you know it." Arnas ignored him. "After that, take the servant and throw him in with the prisoners. He's obviously in collusion with the local rebels." Tavi ground his teeth in sheer frustration, his hands balling into fists. Navaris's snake eyes flicked to him, and her sword slid 3 inches out of its sheath. Tavi heard it then, before anyone else seemed to. In the years since forming the strange bond with Kitai, his senses had grown steadily more aware. Not acute, precisely, so much as they seemed to be losing distinction in their respective acuity. Sense had grown steadily more available, familiar, and recognizable, until they distinguished places and objects in his memory almost as readily as familiar faces distinguished different people. Sounds, too, had changed. They hadn't become any louder, really, so much as they had become increasingly more distinct, until he could frequently sort out who was moving around him and which steed they were mounted on, based on little more than the unique sounds of their breathing. This was a very low sound, one that most people would not notice until it grew more prominent. Horses. Hundreds of them, gathering speed. Crows. This was not what Tavi needed right now. Navaris roughly seized his arm with her left hand, and only then did she notice the sound. She froze, turning her head toward the northern gates of the city. There was an enormous thundering crash, and then the low growl of hoofbeats turned into a staccato roar as a tide of hundreds of hooves struck upon the cobblestones of Othos. bloody crows. This was definitely something none of them needed right now. Unless... A column of cavalry from the 1st Alaran surged into the square from the far side, with Antilla Maximus leading them. The column immediately began splitting apart, falling into ranks with parade ground precision. He'd brought along all four Aeli of cavalry, and they broke into two units, the original Alaran Aeli and the second unit of Marat riders. As Tavi watched, he saw the battle crows bringing up the rear. They dismounted and formed up in a battle square between the cavalry units. The first Alaran's veterans had moved with tremendous speed, and they were in position and ready before the guard could react to their appearance. Trumpets blared in dozens of conflicting calls, drums rolled, and the guard began assembling into ranks, facing the first Alaran. They were disorganized and confused, but what they lacked in coordination, they made up in numbers. Antilla Maximus, armor and helmet shining in the afternoon sun, turned his horse toward the house the senator had appropriated and trotted toward him, somehow imparting an arrogant swagger to his mount's gait. He stopped 10 feet in front of the first rank of opposing legionaries and gave Tavi a casual nod.
"Captain!"
He spoke loudly enough to let the entire square hear, smiling amiably.
"Good afternoon, Tribune," Tavi said, also loudly. "What do you think you're doing here?" "There's a situation back at our camp that requires your attention, sir," Max said. "I took the liberty of bringing a spare horse for you."
He turned the amiable smile to Arnos.
"I'll have my captain back, Senator."
Arnos glared at Max and drew himself up, lifting his chin. Given his silk robes and the fact that the senator was shorter than most women, it looked somewhat ridiculous. The increasing numbers of guard legionaries arriving moment by moment, however, did not.
"Tribune," Arnos barked. "You and these men will disperse, return to camp, and await my orders." "You heard the man, Captain," Max drawled. "Get on the horse and we'll get back to camp." "Disperse, Tribune," Arnos snarled. "Now!"
From the north side of the town, drums rumbled. The sound of the legionaries of the first Alaran singing a quick-step marching song drifted through the air. Arnos turned to Tavi.
"Order them to stand down."
"I'd like to, Senator," Tavi said. "But I've been relieved of command."
"I'll kill them," Arnos said. "One and all."
"That's up to you, of course," Tavi agreed. "But you might give a thought to the consequences of your campaign. You can kill them, but it won't be easy. You'll take heavy losses. And when the dust settles, you'll have less than a third of our current numbers."
Arnos narrowed his eyes.
"We're already outnumbered at least 3 or 4 to 1, sir."
Tavi felt his voice harden.
"Do the math, and then tell me if you think you can carry this campaign to completion."
Arnos looked from Tavi to Max, to the legionaries in the square. The marching song of the first Alaran grew louder. Finally he hissed through his teeth and growled,
"If I must, I will fall back and gather reinforcements for next year. You aren't getting your command back."
"I don't need it," Tavi said.
"Furthermore, I can guarantee that not only will the first Alaran stand down, but that it will willingly march beside you in the rest of the campaign. We both know you're going to need them."
Arnos frowned, suspicious eyes flickering over Tavi's face.
"What do you want?"
"Two things," Tavi said. "First, the people of Othus. Rescind the order."
Arnos snorted.
"And?"
"Turn me over to Captain Narlus and remand me to the stockade at the Elenarch until my trial," Tavi replied.
"Why?"
Arnos demanded.
Tavi glanced at Navaris.
"I'd rather not wake up one day and find that I've somehow sliced open my wrists in my sleep."
Arnos looked back out at the square, which by that time had become a veritable sea of gleaming armor, banners, weapons, and helmets. On the square opposite the first Alaran forces, the banner of Captain Narlus appeared and began marching through the ranks toward Arnos's command.
"Done," Arnos said.
Tavi nodded once and turned to Max.
Tribune?
Sir.
Stand down and return to camp.
Max blinked and stared at Tavi.
Sir?
That is an order, Tribune, Tavi said.
Max's horse danced nervously in place, and the big Antillean shook his head.
No, sir. I'm not leaving here without you, sir.
The senator has found cause to bring treason charges against me. I am confident that I will have an opportunity, he placed a very slight emphasis on the word, to clear up the matter in a trial. For the time being, the regulations must be observed.
Max arched an eyebrow, took a deep breath, and then reluctantly saluted.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Tribune, Tavi said. Max turned and rode back over to the first Alaran, casting a glance over his shoulder as he went. A moment later the formations began to break up, turning to depart the city the way they'd come. A collective sigh of relief from seemingly every man in the square sounded like a wind blowing through tall, thick grass. Tavi felt his own legs sag with relief. A disastrous clash with the guard had been averted, and the people of Othos were spared, one problem neatly solving another. The easy part was over. From here on out, things were going to be a lot more difficult.
Chapter 18. Marcus approached the command tent and nodded to the guard outside.
My name is Marcus. Captain Nalus sent for me.
The guard, a young legionare, came to immediate attention and snapped a precise salute.
Valiar Marcus, sir, he's expecting you. He said to go in, and he'll be along in a moment, sir.
Don't call me sir, sonny, Marcus said. We're all infantry here.
The young legionare grinned and banged out a more natural salute, then swung open the tent's flap. Marcus returned the salute, if more casually than was strictly proper, and stepped inside the tent. It was a bit larger than necessary, and was set up around a central table, rather than having tables line the walls, leaving the center open. That was typical of Nalus. He liked his men facing one another as they worked, talking, communicating.
He was a great one for talking, Nalus.
Marcus tended to prefer the other arrangement. It meant that you always knew the man who was working behind your back. The cot at one side of the room was double-sized, and a stool and a large harp rested at its foot. Marcus walked over to the harp and ran a calloused hand along its wooden frame. The tent flap opened, and Captain Nalus walked in. Marcus turned to him and gave him a sharp salute.
Captain.
Nalus nodded back.
Centurion.
He closed the tent flap behind him. Marcus offered the man a grin and his hand.
Been a while.
Nalus took his hand and smiled in return.
Marcus, thank you for coming.
Well, you're a high and mighty captain now. How could a mere centurion refuse?
Nalus snorted.
It's not much like when we were serving High Lord Antillus,
he said, his tone wry.
Is it? Not much,
Marcus replied.
Great furies, no,
Nalus said quietly.
There never would have been any of that business about executing civilians.
He was quiet for a moment.
Made me sick, Marcus. On the shield wall,
Marcus said quietly,
you always knew who the enemy was.
Nalus frowned at him for a moment, then grimaced and shook his head.
You've got me all wrong. Crows take the politicians, Marcus, and the politics with them. This isn't what I signed up for. I'm just a soldier.
Marcus grunted.
You joined the wrong outfit if you wanted to avoid getting involved.
Nalus shook his head, crossed to a cabinet in the corner of the tent, and took out a dark bottle. He took a long pull from it, and then offered it to Marcus.
This isn't about choosing sides, Marcus.
Marcus looked at the bottle for a moment. He made no move toward it.
Then what is it about?
Nalus took another drink.
A lot of years ago, you taught a young sub-tribune a lot about being a soldier, and a spoiled brat a lot about growing up.
Marcus snorted.
They didn't come much greener than you, that's for sure. You were my teacher. You gave me good advice then. I'm asking for your advice now.
Marcus stared at Narlus for a moment. Then he shook his head and reached out for the bottle. He took a swig, and the almost flavourless hard root liquor, favoured in the frozen north of the realm, burned down his throat.
"Pfaw!" he muttered. "You can get any kind of liquor here, and you stick with this." "Grew on me," Narlus said.
Marcus grunted and said, "Absent friends."
"Absent friends," Narlus replied.
Marcus took another pull and passed the bottle back to Narlus. He waited until the other man drank, then said,
"What do you want to ask me?" "You know I've been given custody of Captain Scipio." "Aye."
Narlus shook his head.
"He's made some requests. He wants to talk to some of his officers before I send him back to Sir Cyril for safekeeping."
Marcus grunted.
"And?"
Narlus stared at Marcus for a second.
"And? Does he really expect me to allow it? The last thing any of us needs is for him to give some order to his men to the effect of, 'The good senator can go to the crows. Or maybe kill that fool Narlus and get me out of here.'"
Marcus nodded. Then he said,
"Ask him not to."
Narlus arched an eyebrow.
"Excuse me? Ask him not to do that."
Narlus let out an exasperated little laugh.
"Just like that. And take his word for it. Oh, the senator would love that."
Marcus took the bottle and swigged again.
"You asked."
Narlus stared hard at Marcus for a full silent minute. Then he swallowed more of the northern liquor and said,
"Really?" "He gives you his word," Marcus said. "He's good for it."
Narlus exhaled. Then he said,
"And you're good for yours."
Marcus took another pull and grimaced.
"Mostly."
Narlus finished the bottle and idly tossed it under his cot. He frowned, brow furrowing. Marcus let him think it over for a moment. Then he said,
"Still playing that old thing, eh?"
Narlus glanced at the harp and lifted one shoulder in a shrug.
Sometimes it helps me sleep."
Marcus nodded at the double-sized cot.
"Thought that's what the women were for."
Narlus flashed a short-lived grin at Marcus. Then he shook his head and replied,
"Not going to be much of that on the campaign."
"No."
"If Scipio talks to his officers," Narlus said, "and tells them to resist Arnus, we won't be able to trust the First Alaren, Marcus. I may be a fool, but I'm not a crow-begotten fool. We're going to need them by the time we get to Mastings. I can't make a bad call on this one."
Marcus clapped Narlus on the shoulder and said quietly,
"Do what you think is best."
Then he turned to leave.
"Marcus?"
Narlus asked. Marcus paused. Narlus took a deep breath.
"I want you to be there."
Marcus turned, nodded, and gave the younger man a salute. Narlus returned it. The sandy-haired young curser, Sir Aaron, was waiting for Marcus as he walked briskly out of the Second Senatorial's camp and back toward the First Alaren's. He fell into pace beside Marcus, though his body language remained that of someone moving separately from the centurion. His lips barely moved when he spoke.
"Well?"
"The captain asked, just like you said he would, and Narlus will allow it."
Aaron's face lit in a brief, fierce grin. "Good." Marcus glanced aside at him.
"What are you going to do?"
Aaron began to speak, but frowned.
"Better for both of us, if you don't know," he said quietly.
Thank the great Furies someone had sense, Marcus thought.
The cursors had taken a lot of losses over the past few years, and he'd come to fear for the quality of the agents that would emerge from the situation. At least this one appeared to have sound judgment. Aaron gave the slightest twitch of a nod to Marcus and vanished down a side street. Marcus continued on his way, at the same businesslike, unwavering pace, and returned to his tent. This time Lady Aquitaine had not bothered with a veil. She sat on his stool in her washerwoman disguise, her face lined with impatience. She rose as he entered, and he felt the air tighten with an interdicting wind-crafting. Marcus nodded to her.
"My lady?"
"Fidelius," she replied, her tone curt. "What did Nullus say?"
"Scipio has requested a conference with his senior officers," Marcus reported.
Lady Aquitaine narrowed her eyes.
"According to Arnus, Scipio stated that he would instruct his officers to support him. But he's a fighter. Surely Nullus isn't going to allow the meeting."
Marcus kept his focus upon the details of his tent. Mundane, familiar things that were not at all out of the ordinary, and with which he interacted on a daily regular basis.
"I advised him against it," he replied.
Lady Aquitaine frowned at him for a moment. Marcus straightened the lay of the blanket on his cot and wondered if he was about to die. She sighed and shook her head.
"Will he take your advice?"
"We can hope so," Marcus said. "Nullus takes some time to make his decisions, but he does his own thinking along the way. He told me that if he did have the conference, he wanted me there. At least I'll be able to report on what happens."
"Never underestimate the ongoing value in a talented protégé," Lady Aquitaine murmured, smiling. "Or how many times they go to their former mentors for advice on their most critical decisions."
"Keep me informed." "Of course, lady."
"What of the villagers?" Lady Aquitaine asked.
"Released and returned to their homes, although Arnus hasn't issued an official countermand to their death warrants."
She shook her head.
"With Scipio out of the picture, there's no longer any reason to threaten them, and there is the potential for serious long-range repercussions. I must admit, my spy, that your suggestion sounded like quite a gamble at first, but it's proven an elegant solution to our problems."
Marcus's stomach twisted. If the captain hadn't played the situation as well as he had.
Aloud, he only said,
"Thank you, lady."
"In your opinion, will the First Alaran support Arnus in the campaign?"
"If Scipio orders it?"
He pursed his lips.
"I think so, yes. They've fought the Khanim for 2 years now. They want to finish the job."
Lady Aquitaine sighed.
"Then it all hinges on Scipio. He has a rather irritating talent for impersonating a fulcrum."
"If he reneges," Marcus pointed out, "there is still the death warrant."
Her face twisted into a moo of distaste.
"True, but will it be enough to compel him to keep his word?"
"Partly," Marcus said. "But bear in mind that he plans surprisingly well for the long term for someone of his age. Throwing his legion's support behind the campaign is at this point arguably the best way to keep his men and his officers alive, united, and ready to support him again in the future."
Lady Aquitaine arched an eyebrow at that, and waved her hand in a gesture that admitted the possibility. Then she rose and gathered up the laundry, a small smile on her mouth.
"I'm not worried about his long-range plans. We're nearly there. You have served me very well, my Fidelius. I shall not forget it."
He bowed his head to Lady Aquitaine, and she departed.
He sank down to sit on his cot and closed his eyes. The panic and fear he'd kept hidden inside him when he lied to Lady Aquitaine's face rushed back through him. His forehead beaded with a cold sweat, and his hands started shaking.
Should Lady Aquitaine come to power, she would need the appearance, at least, of integrity. And Marcus knew far too many damning facts about both her and her husband. True, she had a certain amount of integrity, but also true, she allowed no one and nothing to hamper her aims. It had taken him years to see the absolute voracious nature of her ambition. He followed the chain of logic to its most probable conclusion. Once she and her husband had the crown, Marcus would be a liability, suited only for removal. Optionally, if she ever realized that he had turned against her, she would wipe him from the earth. And should the captain ever learn his true identity, Marcus judged that he would react with less dramatic but equally effective prejudice. Marcus sat on the cot with his hands shaking.
He'd kept the captain alive, at least. That was something. As long as he was alive, the young man would be in action. And Marcus was sure that the captain had no intention of sitting quietly in a cell while the Aquitaine's puppet senator ran up a string of victories and the prestige and influence that would come with them. As long as the captain was alive and able to act, there was hope for Alera's future. Just not for his own.
To the crows with it. He'd never planned on dying of old age in any case.
Chapter 19. Bernard suddenly froze, then lifted his hand and flattened it out again at his side, the signal to take cover. Amara hurried 2 steps forward to support Gaius as he went awkwardly to one knee, clutching the walking staff Bernard had cut for him after they'd set out on the trail again. She helped the First Lord to lie down flat on the cool, damp earth and then followed suit. Gaius let out a hiss of pain and clutched at his leg before going still and silent again. His expression was twisted into a pained grimace. Amara laid a hand on the old man's arm by way of encouragement and frowned at Bernard, or more accurately at where she presumed Bernard was still standing. The shadows of the very trees and brush of the forest itself had fallen over him like a cloak, and the wood crafting hid him entirely from view. She heard a soft step on the ground in front of her, and then the light changed subtly as Bernard's woodcrafting slipped over her and the First Lord. Bernard became visible to her as it happened, though his features were softened and dimmed, as if by a deep shadow. He had his bow in hand as he stood over them, an arrow on the string, and his eyes were focused intently ahead of them. Then Amara heard it, the click, 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 click of a walking horse's hooves striking a firm trail. They were joined by the sounds of several more, and within half a minute she saw the riders appear. There were 6 of them, all dressed in woodsman's leathers, though each wore a device upon the front of his jacket set with the green and grey colours of Calare. Outriders, then, for a legion. Or more likely bandits, who had accepted Calaris's coin and authority to continue doing what they always did, plus the occasional odd job. They were heavily armed, each bearing a huntsman's bow, a broad-headed spear, and additional blades and axes strapped to their saddles. They passed by in silence but for the steps of their mounts. This was the 2nd such patrol they had come across in 2 days, though the other had been more than twice as far away. These men were close enough for Amara to see the stains on their tunics and the scuff marks on their boots. She found herself holding her breath, straining to remain silent. The patrol passed by, and Amara slowly began to relax again, until the last rider looked around, then reined in his horse and dropped to the forest floor. He tossed the ends of his reins over a low-hanging branch and began walking toward them. Bernard moved very slowly, very calmly. He lifted his bow and drew it in careful, deliberate silence. The outlaw swerved away from them when he was less than 20 feet off, sighed, and began relieving himself against the trunk of a tree. Though Amara could not even string her husband's bow, Bernard held the powerful weapon at full draw without a quiver. He remained still, his breathing measured, his eyes half-closed and lazy-looking. Amara felt herself quivering with tension, and she realized that her knuckles had gone white where she had a hold of the First Lord's forearm. She itched to move her hand down to her sword, but refrained. The motion might stir a leaf or break a twig and warn the enemy of their presence. More to the point, her sword wouldn't do her any good at the moment, even were it already in her hand. Bernard's bow would be their best defense. The bandit finished up, muttered something under his breath, and turned to go. Gaius's weight shifted. Amara glanced sideways at him in alarm. His face had gone pale with pain, and his right leg, the one still recovering from his injuries, was quivering against the ground. It didn't make much noise, but it was enough. The outlaw suddenly turned, his hand flying to his sword, his eyes narrow as they scanned the forest around them. Amara was lying utterly unprotected on the forest floor, within range of a good long lunge, and the man was facing her. He simply stared, eyes moving slowly from left to right. He stood there for a full minute, just looking and listening. Amara's nerves began screaming in anxiety. If the First Lord's leg twitched again, there was no chance, none at all, that the man would miss it. If he had the capacity to craft through Bernard's woodcrafting, he would be within a heartbeat of striking out at Gaius, unless Bernard's first shot was instantly lethal. If the man managed to survive the first shot, even if only briefly, Gaius might not be able to defend himself. If that happened, Amara would have to put herself between the outlaw and the First Lord, and she drew upon Cirrus to give her limbs the speed she would need to interpose herself in time. All the while, Bernard stood directly in front of the man, bow drawn, never moving.
"What the crows are you doing?"
blared a sudden voice. Amara jerked in surprise and half-panicked as the movement stirred the earth and brush beneath her. The outlaw didn't hear it. He reacted the same way, whirling in place and drawing his sword.
"Crows take you, Tonner!" the outlaw growled. "Scared me out of 10 years of life!"
Another outlaw appeared, his horse nudging slowly through the brush toward the first man.
"Life you lead, I did you a favor, bastard!" "You don't go off alone, fool!"
Tonner said amiably.
"Do it again and Julius will have your balls!" "Julius!"
the outlaw said, his voice sullen.
"He has us riding around in Crowbegot nowhere when there's a war on. You know what kind of loot we could be getting if we were at the real fight? Stomach plague, mostly, the way I hear it. We're getting paid steady for this. Don't knock it." "There's no spy running around out here," the outlaw complained. "We're wasting our time. Knights Aeris don't fly this far behind enemy lines for no reason. They either dropped someone off or picked someone up, in which case we're out here wearing our asses to nothing for no reason. You're riding. You're getting paid. Maybe we find someone, maybe we don't. Either we get the 500 bull bounty or we go back without anybody trying to gut us. There's no loser here. Except me, Tonner. I have to listen to you run your mouth. You don't get that nag back in line, you won't have to listen to anything ever again,"
Tonar replied. Then he turned his horse away and continued on in the direction he had been. The outlaw scowled after him, savagely kicked a stone on the ground. The stone bounded across the earth and bounced off of Bernard's leg. Amara tensed, but the outlaw hadn't seen it. He had already turned to his horse. He mounted, kicked the animal with unnecessary vigor, and sent it cantering after the rest of his party. Bernard didn't lower his bow until a full minute after the man was out of sight. Then he released the tension on the weapon and his breath with the same slow, careful exhalation. He lowered the bow and rolled his right shoulder, as if working out stiffness. Then he turned back to Amara.
"I'm going to shadow them for a bit," he murmured. "Make sure that they're not doubling back. Stay here. Stay low. I'll be back shortly."
"Be careful," she told him. He winked at her and then turned away. The woodcrafting slid away from Amara, and the dappled sunlight brightened again, bright enough to make her squint against it. She turned to Gaius and whispered, "Sire, are you all right?"
"Leg cramped,"
Gaius growled softly.
"Started twitching."
He rubbed one hand hard on his right leg.
"Crows, that's uncomfortable.
Pardon my language, Countess."
"Yes, sire," Amara said, giving him a small smile. She glanced after Bernard and said, "We can change the bandages while we're here." Gaius grimaced but nodded to her. He hauled himself about roughly, sitting up and extending his right leg toward her. "Well," she said as she went to work, "what did you think of that?"
"I think our young friend there isn't going to survive this patrol," Gaius replied.
His voice tightened as she peeled the bandages from his right foot, revealing the discolored sores that had refused to completely heal.
"And I think it's lucky they rode by in front of us.
If we'd passed through a few minutes sooner, they'd have walked right across our trail and followed it straight to us.
Amara got out the canteen of salted water and poured it over Gaius's foot. He looked away, his expression distant and cool, but his leg jerked as the cleansing wash entered the sores. Amara set about washing and drying his foot, then putting a fresh bandage over it, before replacing his stocking and the heavy leather slipper Bernard had fashioned for Gaius.
"Quite cool in a crisis, your man," Gaius sighed once she was finished.
"You noticed. I thought I was going to have to scream at the end there."
"As was I, though for different reasons. I didn't dare use any metal crafting to keep the pain down."
He smiled and dug into his pack, extracting a flask of water. He swallowed most of it down and then settled back onto the forest floor again, closing his eyes.
"I can't ever remember going for so long without performing any crafting. It's like walking around with my feet and hands asleep all the time. I hadn't realized how difficult it would be."
He shook his head once, then closed his eyes and dropped into what looked like a light slumber. Amara didn't disturb him. Though Gaius had insisted upon moving ahead, each hour cost him considerable effort. Though he never complained, the pain of his foot clearly wore greatly on him, and he leaned more heavily on the staff as each day went on. She sat down with her back to a tree, drew her sword, and quietly stood watch over the sleeping First Lord, until Bernard suddenly appeared from beneath his woodcrafting half an hour later. Amara twitched in surprise and frowned at him.
"Sorry,"
he murmured. Then he knelt down and hugged her. Amara sighed, shook her head, and returned the embrace. He felt large and strong and warm, and she suddenly felt a great deal less worried. She knew that it was really a somewhat ridiculous thing to feel. Bernard, after all, was as vulnerable to harm as anyone. But somehow, when he was holding her, that didn't matter. She felt better for no rational reason at all. And she loved that feeling.
"How is he?"
Bernard rumbled quietly. "The same. Or if he's any better, I can't see it. Bernard, shouldn't those sores have closed by now?"
"Hmm," he said. "Older folks can be slow to heal without a water crafter to help them. He hasn't any fever, and there's no sign of blood poisoning. I'd prefer it if he rested for a couple of days, but..."
"But he won't," Amara sighed.
"It could be worse," Bernard said. "So long as they close up before we hit the swamps, we should be all right."
"What if they don't?" Amara asked him. He leaned back from her and traced a fingertip over her cheekbone. She closed her eyes and leaned into his touch.
"We'll worry about that if it happens,"
he said quietly. Gaia stirred and sat up, blinking his eyes once or twice. He nodded to Bernard.
"Count, our friends have moved on?"
Bernard nodded.
"Yes, sire. It won't hurt us to take a bit of rest here if you like."
The First Lord shook his head, planted his staff, and clambered to his feet.
"No, out of the question. We've no time to spare." "Aye, sire," Bernard said.
He offered Amara a hand up, and she squeezed his fingers once after she was on her feet. Bernard set off in the lead of the little group again, and Gaius grunted with discomfort on his first few steps, then determinedly lengthened his stride, using his staff to help him. Amara stared at the limping First Lord for a moment, biting her lip. Then she followed him, glancing frequently around them and over her shoulder, and they continued on their way to Kalare. Chapter 20. Isana followed the young valet to Sir Cyril's office on the ground floor of the Legion's command building. Only a single legionary was on duty at the door this time. Indeed, since the First Aleran and the Guard Legions had departed, the entire town of Elinarch seemed almost deserted, and any little sound rang out with an eerie clarity in the quiet streets. The valet led her through a little antechamber and nodded at the door. "There you are, Steadholder."
"Thank you," Isana said quietly. "Should I knock?"
The valet shook his head.
"He's expecting you, ma'am."
Isana nodded at the young man and turned to the office door. She opened it and stepped into a rather large office. It was crowded with tables and bookshelves, all of them neatly, precisely stacked with books, papers and scrolls. One wall was covered entirely by at least a dozen maps on broad sheets of parchment. Sir Cyril sat behind a much-used wooden desk, and he rose with a polite smile. Isana felt it when a flash of pain went through the remains of his leg, a savage stroke of agony that bored into the joint of his thigh and hip. Her own leg twitched in sympathy at the ghostly sensation. She felt him assert control over the pain an instant later, smothering the fire of it in a blanket of pure determination.
"No, please, sir," Isana said. "Don't get up."
"Nonsense," Sir Cyril said.
He swept into a restrained bow.
"It's not often I entertain a celebrity."
She shook her head wryly and replied with a simple curtsy.
"Hardly that."
"I disagree," Cyril said, sitting again.
He let out an almost inaudible sigh of relief as he took the weight off of his leg.
"I've gotten several letters mentioning that you'd favorably impressed many of the realm's citizenry during your abolition campaign."
"As of yet, no laws have been passed," she said, her voice dry. "It's been 2 years.
I can hardly call that impressive." "Big change takes time," Cyril replied,
his tone a polite disagreement.
"And the war has certainly been..."
He glanced at his leg and flashed a quick, wry grin at Isana.
"A distraction."
"Certainly that," she agreed.
"Even leaving such matters aside, this relief column you organized is a rare thing," he continued. "It's already saving lives."
She shook her head. "Any number of people could have done what I have."
"But they didn't," Cyril said. "You did."
"Someone had to."
He tilted his head and studied her for a moment, then shrugged and said,
"Someone should have. It isn't the same thing."
Isana waved a hand.
"Sir Cyril, I hope you don't think I'm rude for saying this, but I can't imagine why you sent for me."
He gave her a steady look, and his speculative gaze was intense enough that she could almost feel it on her skin.
"Can't you?" he asked.
Isana sighed. "Honestly, I can't. I was packing to leave, in fact. So, Sir Cyril, I ask you again, why am I here?" Cyril's eyebrows went up.
"This is somewhat disappointing," he offered her a whimsical smile. "I was hoping you would tell me."
He raised his voice and called,
"Garlan, send him in, please."
The door opened a moment later, and a tall man in a fine Legion-issue dress tunic entered the...
Tavi entered the room, she corrected herself.
His green eyes fell on her, and his step slowed in hesitation for just a moment. She felt a surge of emotion from him, so mixed and confused that she hardly knew what to make of it, other than to sense a good deal of anger mixed through it all, unless it was humiliation or...
Great furies.
Araris had told him. Isana stared at Tavi for a second, meeting his gaze. He nodded to her and said,
"Excuse me."
As he did, the fountain of emotion began to dwindle until there was nothing more coming from him. He had been able to hide his feelings from her since he'd been 11 years old. It had always made her a little proud of him, as well as exasperated. He'd been entirely too creatively energetic at that age. She'd needed every advantage she could get to stay a step ahead of his mischief, and they were not alone, she reminded herself. She glanced aside at Cyril, then rose politely, offering another curtsy to Tavi, precisely as she had to Cyril.
"Good morning, Captain."
Tavi smiled at her and inclined his head.
"Steadholder, thank you for coming, and thank you for seeing me, Sir Cyril."
Isana tilted her head.
"Why aren't you with your legion, Captain?"
"Hmm," Cyril said. "I was wondering the same thing myself. Narlus's letter was painfully vague."
"I've been arrested and charged with treason, Steadholder," Tavi replied cheerfully. "They sent me back here in irons, though Sir Cyril was kind enough to accept my parole and have them stricken."
He held up his wrists, each of them ringed with bruises and small cuts. Isana blinked for a moment and fought to keep herself from gasping or letting out a cry of distress, not in front of Sir Cyril.
"Treason," Cyril said, sighing. "What happened out there?"
"Long story," Tavi said.
He put a hand on the chair Isana had been sitting in, holding it for her.
"Steadholder, shall we sit?"
Isana frowned gently at him, trying to understand what was behind his expression. But he was closed to her. Yes. She'd known him that well, at least. He'd reacted just as she feared he would.
"Crows take Araris," she thought quietly, sadly.
"But not until after they've taken me, and the Slives who made it necessary to take every measure in reach to protect him, including lying to him."
Araris had been right, of course. Tavi had deserved to know. But she had wanted to put it off for just one more day, and now... Sometimes it felt like everything she turned her hand to withered and died. It was ridiculous, of course. Not everything had. Her steadhold was prospering, after all. The relief column had been a success. Perhaps it was only when her heart was involved that she had such ruinous bad fortune. Or, she thought, ruinously bad judgment. Credit where credit is due. They all sat down. Cyril settled in to listen to Tavi, one elbow on the desk, his fist supporting his chin.
"This should be interesting."
Tavi leaned back in his chair and somehow managed to look lazily confident, even while in a relaxed slouch, his legs stretched out in front of him and crossed at the ankles. Then he started talking. It didn't take Isana long to realize that Tavi was saying more than he probably should have about the motivations and twisted loyalties behind the events of the past several days, which is to say that he was being completely open and honest.
"Let me get this straight," Cyril said when Tavi paused for breath. "After Arnos lost many of his own knights' heiress, precisely as we warned him he would, you then bailed his men out of the trouble he'd bought them."
"You should have heard what was going around the guard camps before I left," Tavi said with another grin.
Isana had never seen the expression on Tavi's face, but it had been common enough on his father's. Septimus had grinned at frustration and pain, too.
"According to the guard, I waited overly long to help so that I could play the hero and rub their noses in their inexperience."
Cyril snorted.
"Arnos has always known how to play a crowd. After you did that, he ordered you to execute the prisoners. You refused the order and he had you arrested."
"Not exactly," Tavi said. "I was still stalling carrying the order out. I had the opportunity for a rendezvous with a representative from the Khanim. Arnos caught me after and leveled the treason charges. He refused to rescind the execution order, by the way."
"Executing civilians? Families?" Isana heard herself say.
"What kind of madness is that?"
"An increasingly common one, unfortunately," Cyril said soberly. "All this ambition being brewed with self-interest under increasing amounts of pressure."
He shook his head and turned back to Tavi.
"I assume he was holding them against your good behavior."
Tavi's smile turned sharper.
"Yes. Though I found a way to make sure he'd leave them alone."
Cyril tilted his head.
"How?"
I left Crassus in command of the Legion, Tavi said, smirking. Cyril arched both eyebrows, then leaned his head back to laugh, a short, genuine sound.
That would do it.
Excuse me, Isana said quietly. Do what?
Crassus's father is High Lord Antillus Raucus, Tavi said, still grinning. His mother is High Lord Calaris's youngest sister. Once the fighting is done, Crassus may well be declared Calaris's heir. He already is Antillus's heir. If Arnas ordered him to execute the prisoners and he refused, which he would, Cyril said. Tavi nodded. Arnas would have little choice but to press charges against Crassus if he wanted to maintain the integrity of his charges against me.
Ah, Isana said, nodding. And given Crassus's family connections and what will probably be a very influential future, it would be stupid for Arnas to make an enemy of him now.
Oh, he's stupid enough to do it, Tavi said. But there's also the fact that if Arnas played that game on the son and heir of Antillus Raucus, the patronage of the Aquitanes wouldn't stop Lord Antillus for a second. He would call Arnas out to the Juris Macto and scatter the leftover pieces all over Alera.
Only if the old man beat Maximus to it, Cyril noted.
Tavi grinned.
Crows, yes. Max would love an excuse to call Arnas out. Defending the honor of his family and father would be undeniable.
I'm surprised Arnas let you talk to your officers, Cyril said. It's not the kind of mistake I'd expect of him.
He didn't, Tavi said. Max and about 700 veterans were in a position to dispute the legitimacy of my arrest.
What?
Cyril just stared at Tavi for a second, his face going white. Isana sensed the horror boiling up out of him like some kind of greasy black vapor. Then he shook his head slowly.
700.
He blew out a slow breath.
That was exactly the kind of situation the Crown wished us to avoid.
Tavi grimaced.
I know.
I talked Arnas into letting Nalus handle my arrest in exchange for ordering them to stand down. Cyril mopped a hand over his face.
Nalus, he said distantly. No wonder his letter was so awkward. Decent man. Not terribly intelligent, but I've always thought well of him.
He asked me to give him my word that I wasn't going to order my men to get me out or refuse to support the campaign. I gave it, and he let me meet with them.
Cyril frowned hard at Tavi, and Isana could feel the anger in it, mixed with a certain admiration.
And your orders to them?
Tavi blinked, lifting his eyebrows in faint surprise.
To support the campaign, of course. To do everything they could to preserve the lives of Alerans and secure the realm against the invaders.
Cyril let out a slow breath, sagging a little at the table, and his relief flooded through the room.
Thank the great Furies. There's that much, at least.
Tavi grimaced. Arnas is planning a campaign of numbers. He's tallied every life to be sacrificed.
Cyril grimaced. Yes, I suspected as much. Can he win?
Tavi shrugged.
I think Nasorg does his math a bit differently. Othos was a bloody mess, and at a bargain for the Khanim.
Tavi's voice lowered and his smile vanished.
I've got to stop him, Cyril.
Cyril looked from Tavi to Isana, frowning. The room was quiet for several seconds.
Someone needs to, Cyril agreed. But there are two problems. First, you aren't going to stop him from doing much of anything from inside the stockade. Second, I don't see any feasible way of doing so, even if you weren't.
Tavi took a deep breath. I think I might know a way, he said.
Cyril nodded.
This meeting you had with a representative, I expect. What does Nasorg want?
Can't tell you, Tavi said. Safer for both of us.
Cyril leaned back in his chair and put both hands flat on his desk.
You want me to release you?
Yes.
I can't do that.
Yes, you can, Tavi said. Cyril, if this works, it has the potential to end the fighting entirely. I think those three legions would do a lot more good flanking Kalaris than running